Hello, and welcome to State of Our Workforce. My name is Michelle Wilson, and I am the Director of Evaluation and Learning at the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. Each month on State of Our Workforce, we take a journey into the heart of workforce innovation and explore how to build an equitable workforce. Workforce development is at a critical inflection point. The economy is shifting, technology is evolving faster than ever, and employers are rethinking what it means to build and sustain their workforce. But even as we see new opportunities emerge, we're still confronting deep inequities that prevent too many people, especially workers of color, from thriving. So, what will it take to truly build an equitable workforce? What needs to change in our systems, our policies, and our mindsets to make equity the default and not the exception? To help us unpack these questions, we're joined by three incredible leaders who are shaping the future of workforce equity. Michelle Rafferty, Chief Programs Officer at the National Fund for Workforce Solutions; Melissa Johnson, Chief of Policy and State Strategies at the National Skills Coalition; and Tamisha Bridges Mansfield, founder of Beloved Praxis Consulting. Together, we'll explore what's working, what's not, and where the greatest opportunities for meaningful change lie, from the policies that shape opportunity to the innovations redefining how we think about workforce equity. Join us. So I am super happy to be in this space today with like titans. Are you guys considered titans of industry? Is that a thing? Can we do that?
Today, sure.
For sure, something like that. Like three dope souls. How about that? I'm here with three dope souls, and I'm excited to have this conversation, right? These are folks that I look up to a whole bunch, and I listen to what they have to say, and so I'm interested to dig in. Hey, Tamisha.
Hello. It's great to be here. Thank you for the invitation, Michelle.
Hey, Melissa.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And Rafferty, Michelle Rafferty, should we figure this out? In National Fund world, she's the other Michelle, and then sometimes she's Raf. But I guess since I'm interviewing you today, you can have the title of Michelle.
I've been waiting for this moment, Michelle. Thank you so much to reclaim my identity. I really appreciate it.
I know. You're welcome. Yeah. All right, ladies, you ready to jump in?
Let's do it.
Yep.
So it's 2025, and the conversation around workforce equity is evolving, and what it looks like, or is it evolving, or what is it? But so when we think about workforce equity, and I just want to dive into that, what does that actually mean to you in this moment? And jump in wherever and whenever around that. I'll kick it off with you, Tamisha.
Oh, okay. Gosh, it's interesting. When I was looking over the questions, I was like, ooh, this is a big question, and I appreciate you being bold to stay and keep the word equity in the conversation so that it doesn't get lost. I just want to say that up front. But, when I think about workforce equity, and I like that term more than workforce development, because for me, when I think about it, it really is about a holistic view, mm-hmm. right? And it's not just about workforce development from the way I think we've historically thought about it in terms of training and then rapid attachment into the workforce, but it really is around economic mobility, and that it really gives people the space to really explore and live into their full potential, right? Regardless of who they are and where they're from. So I will continue to take a like worker and community-centered kind of frame when I think about workforce development, not because employers don't matter, but because I think workers and community are still at the center of it and should be. And I would also say that, like, as I think about this more holistic view of workforce development, that it's not saying that skills and education don't matter, because they do, right? But it's right. That we also help people think about what are their employment options, what are their entrepreneurship options, what are their community and support options, and that we look at people across the lifespan so that nobody gets left behind.
So it's interesting. I appreciate that. Well said. And I'm so is that how you're how are you bringing that into your new work as a consultant? So and also shout out to you for love it, but say a little bit about what you're doing.
Thank you. Yeah, so I started Beloved Praxis Consulting in the summer, and it comes from the idea of beloved community, right? I think a lot of us already know what that means, but I also wanted to ground it in practice, and that's why I attached the name Praxis to it so that we can keep both our idealism but also be willing to roll up our sleeves. And so when I think about it in terms of the work that I do within the consultancy, it really is bringing that holistic view into the work. I do not consider myself a workforce development consultant. I consider myself an economic mobility consultant. And I'm willing to work and ride with anybody, whether it's philanthropy, whether it's other nonprofit organizations, and even businesses who really want to dive in and think about their strategies, their community engagement processes, their research, their narrative work in that more holistic frame. So I carry that with me in my work. I use it in the questions that I ask, and I use it in the clients that I want to engage with.
That's beautiful. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Melissa Johnson, new chief. Who dis? Tell us about what you, I knew that would crack you up, Rafferty. I'm sorry, Michelle. Melissa, tell us a little bit about your new role and how you all are thinking about workforce equity and what that actually means to you, and right for now, where we are now.
Sure. So I'm now the Chief of Policy and State Strategies for National Skills Coalition. In this role, I was formerly Managing Director of State Strategies for National Skills Coalition. So I feel like I just get the chance to do all the things that I was doing to advance state policy and policy more largely on the next level. So this is a really great time, I think, in NSC's history. We have our new CEO, Burke Dorensis, and then our executive team, including Katie Spiker and TC Hutcherson. And we'll be making an announcement soon about our new COO. So just happy to join the executive team and continue on the next iteration of this work.
Oh, I was gonna say,
Oh, no, go ahead.
we have tens of listeners, so you can go ahead and drop a bomb or like you can go ahead and tell us who the COO is here now. You can do that if you wanted to.
I don't know if I can though. I want to respect her privacy.
No, that's fair. This is just me trying to play, deep journalist, right? Getting a scoop. No,
Late breaking news. I feel it. I wanted to be upper for a hot minute too. I appreciate it though, like where you started this question about like, are we changing equity? Because I feel like
Right.
this is that's the question now, right? When I looked at this question, I was like, I went back to our speaking of doing the same things, but getting a chance to do it at a different level. Like I went back to our roadmap for racial equity that we did back in 2019,
I was
and we
just looking
used. Yeah, we I literally keep it on my desk. It's
at
right
that.
here. That we use the Center for Social Inclusion's definition, and I think it's still relevant, right? We're still working towards a country and a world where race or immigration status is not correlated with your outcomes. And I really love, Tamisha, that you said that you see yourself as an economic mobility consultant, not just workforce development, because I think that's a part of it too, right? Like we're not just in workforce development for the sake of getting anyone any job. Like we're in it to change people's lives, right? And we want everyone to have a fair chance to change their life through this work. So that's how I see it as well.
Michelle, tell us more. Tell us more.
Well, Melissa, I think what you said really resonates with me and with the National Fund. Part of our vision is that race does not dictate career outcomes. And to me, when I think about equity, that's really what it's about, is that race or other intersecting identities don't correlate with whether or not you can get a job, what type of job you can get, what money you make, your opportunities. And that's not how our world is currently structured. It doesn't happen right now. So, to me, it also means not just looking at giving people opportunities to the education, training, and supports that they need to experience economic mobility, but at the National Fund, we think a lot about job quality and how part of it, inequity shows up in the way that jobs that are predominantly held by Black women, other women of color, or women in general, they're devalued. And these are jobs that are so critical to all of our well-being, in terms of healthcare support jobs, childcare worker jobs. They're skilled jobs, they're critical, and they need to be paid and at a higher rate. And that to me is a reflection of a deep-seated inequity in this country.
Yeah, so Raph, Michelle, sorry, that brings me, like, as I listen to you all speak about this, and I think about, my question is around, what does success look like, not just in the data, but really like in the lives of lived experiences of workers? And it goes beyond, like, how do you know when you're seeing real movement and not just in measurement? Like, what does it look like on the ground for folks? Anybody feel free to think or push back on that, or
Michelle, you kind of stole a little bit of my thunder though when you said just in the data, because I was like, well, we gotta start with
Well, yeah,
the
I mean, certainly start with the data, but then, but how does that translate into what it looks like on the ground for people in real time, right?
Well, to combine the two a little bit, I think if I'm a person of color looking for a particular training program or a certificate or credential or degree to change my life, like, I need to have access to a coach or data and or data to help me make that decision. So I think that is one of the ways that if we were truly in an equitable environment, like, we would see that difference in our lives. In our lives and in workers' lives. And then really quickly too, I think another way that we would see the difference, that we would know we've achieved equity, is that we wouldn't be talking about as much the need for more people with more credentials, because we would have closed certain gaps, right? The reason why we don't have the number of people with post-secondary training that we need is because we haven't met people where they are. We haven't provided them the supports that they need, including that data, including that career navigation. So I think those are two ways that I think our world would be different if we were truly achieving equity.
Yeah, you answered my yes. Other thoughts? Yes. Other.
I mean, I do think that data is important because that's how we measure the gaps, right? And that's how we measure the inequities because we have the data. And so I would say that one measure of success is that we are able to continue collecting the data, right? That we can still capture that data, we can still tell those stories, we can still have that information to really be able to know whether or not we're meeting the mark. And I would also add that I think that for me, another part of success is that businesses are incented to really invest in their workers, and that's where job quality comes in, right? That there is a mechanism, hopefully a carrot and not a stick, right? For employers to really like put money into training for their incumbent workers so they recognize how to do skills-based environments in their organizations and not just like hiring, right? That businesses see, and I think it happens at the margins when there's like a pain point that needs to be addressed and workers are a problem that they need to address. But employers just did it off the rip because they know that they'll have better results, and it and that all workers across an organization have access to be able to build on their skills, to have good jobs, to have the things that they need to thrive. And it's not just what is given to folks in the middle and the top, right? Of a workplace, but your entry-level workers have the opportunity to, and your frontline workers have opportunity to. That opportunity is spread. And so I think that for me is a is another thing that I think about when I think about how do we know we get it right.
I was just thinking about what it looks like on the ground when you go beyond the data, how that shows up in real life. But my next question really is thinking, and Raph, I'm sorry, Michelle, did you have anything that you wanted to say about that?
In terms of how do we know if we're advancing equity?
Well, how do you know when you're seeing real movement just versus just the measurement of it?
Yeah. I mean, I think just, building off what Tamisha and Melissa were saying, it would be that any person, no matter what community they live in or what high school they are going to, what they have access to, that they have the same sense of what's possible for themselves. That everything feels as open to them, different career choices as anyone else. Like that would be the dream that it doesn't, yeah, that you have access to the same types of information and opportunity, no matter what your identity and all different types of levels in terms of identity.
So when you think about the ecosystem, the workforce ecosystem, where are we failing workers, particularly those who are most impacted by inequitable opportunities or who get left out of the conversations? And I'm thinking from a policy standpoint, but where are we not doing what we're supposed to be doing? Where are we cutting?
I mean, we don't have a good system in place. Like we have K through 12, no matter where you are in the country, you're going to have access to public education. That's great. And then that is unequal a bit in terms of how we prepare people for careers. But then
A
once
bit,
they're out,
a bit,
a
Michelle.
bit, emphasis on a lot. But once you leave K through 12, like what is there? There really is no system. You might be someone who's lucky enough to learn about your local American Job Center, and you find some support and resources there. You go to community college and you find some access to information there. But there's no cohesive system at all. And depending on where you end up going, that's going to determine what you have access to. So if you go into an American Job Center and they have different requirements they have to meet to maintain their funding, they're going to be focusing on informing you about short-term training. And for some people, that can be great, but it's going to be more narrow. And same thing with community colleges, where you might have one advisor who's working with thousands of students. There's no customized one-on-one approach to help someone really figure out what they're interested in and what their options are and how to get there. I don't know how anyone, I think it's a miracle when anyone finds their way to a career that they love that did not have someone in their corner, family or other social network really helping to educate them and lead the way. Otherwise, it's very, very challenging.
Just to build on that, I mean, plus one to that, I think the one of the main issues is that we have, like you said, Michelle, like no cohesive system. We have, in some cases, some bright spots of ways that people are being supported to find their next career, right? Great community college program or a great career pathways program. But there are a number of different like systems changes, policy changes that could all be working together to meet people where they are, that we have not funded and thought of as a holistic system together. So I'm thinking of like, what does your training for frontline workforce development professionals look like? What does your career coaching and navigation at the community college system look like? Sector partnerships, pre-apprenticeships, correctional education, right? So meeting people in these different places, right? Wraparound supports for anyone in any of those systems, including removing work requirements for some of those supports that we have. So, like I said, we have these different, in some cases, bright spots of potential support for people, but we haven't funded and looked at it holistically, so that people are not running into barriers when they try to better themselves.
Now, what does that look like in today times in terms of getting to where you need to be to do exactly what you say needs to happen? What thoughts on what how we get there? Do you know what I mean? Because it's, I mean, it's like, I mean, if we're being real in the conversation, right? Everything is so polarized, and politics drives a lot of it. All kinds of politics, right? Not any one particular thing, right, in that space, but all of it gets in the way of supporting workers, particularly the ones who are being left behind. But I just, I mean, I'm what do we do? What's the next step?
Go ahead, Tamisha.
She's on mute. She's on mute. Is
Yeah,
that a
no,
fair question? Is
yeah,
that a fair
here
question, y'all? Because I
it
just, I mean, I really want to see
comes.
it. Let's just dig into it and let's just talk about it.
I mean, I think that, because I think as I was thinking about this question, I have a lot of ways we're falling short, but one of them that I think a lot about is around kind of like the safety nets really unraveling as it relates to work requirements. Like, that's a huge one. But then, like, to your point around the polarization that exists at the, particularly at the federal level, for me, when I think about like what works, I think, or like what a solution can be, or where we can find the solution, it's like old organizing 101. You go back down to where people have power and ideas and organizing. And I think in this field, organizing is a scary word, is a crazy word. Nobody want to do it. And
Say
those
more
who
about
want to
that,
do it.
Tanisha. Why?
Yeah, I
Why
mean,
are you so scared of it? Because I agree with you.
I mean, I think that, and I think both you all at the National Fund and also at Skills Coalition are figuring out how to organize it. You may call it you how to do organizing. You call it networks, but at its core, it's still organizing, right? At its core, it's still around talking with people who are at the local level and figuring out what are your unique pain points, what are your leverage points, where do you hold power, where you can change things. And I feel like we're in this like space where if you can't move stuff at the federal level, what is it that we can do to move stuff at the local level? Where is there space for innovation and investment at the local level, whether that's with philanthropy, whether that's with businesses, whether that's just with people like coming together to say things are not working? I don't know when this is going to air, but you know that also happens.
Tomorrow.
But I think about right, but I think about that. Like I think about like how is it that we can at the institutional level with organizations like yours and our national organizations stay committed to working at the local level and resourcing at the local level so that people can do good work. But then on the flip side, what is the narrative change work and the investments to lift up those stories and take them back up? So that when opportunities open for collaboration and good work at the federal level, we have actual examples of what works. And it's how do you have that like that loop of good work and investment at the local level, lifting it up as an example, and then giving it as an example and as a resource to folks at the federal level to then, you know, put money or change laws to make them happen in real or at the federal level. So for me, it's that like that loop again. That makes it real. I want to kind of go back to one of the other question around like where are we falling short? And it gets to what you guys were saying around like K through 12 and then folks fall off. And I feel like right now the conversations around training or the debate around training or education that's happening right now for me is really scary for young people. Because like there's this thing that's happening where it's this like push towards push and dis and push towards don't go to college, go, you know, stay, go to go get a credential, coupled with this weird like anti-intellectualism and disinvestment in four-year institutions that will still only be available for the shrinking privileged few. And then like what are we like? It's just I think it puts young people in a really unfortunate space where not only do they not have good career navigation and good counseling, but the options that are being presented to them are shrinking as well, either because federal financial aid, as we knew it, is like practically gone, right? Which then pushes young people into a very specific path. And it's just, I don't know, it's something that I've been thinking a lot about. And it's like, where are the solutions for that so that young people, and I think some of it you have to rely back on communities and family to be like, you know, when you ask young people, what do you want to be when you grow up? But we ask that question more and then we put options in front of them.
Yes, say that.
Because I don't know if the systems as we know it are going to support them to be able to really investigate and interrogate what's before them, because we're just in this like this space where we're pitting two things against each other that shouldn't be pitted against each other. And the only people that are going to really be impacted by that, unfortunately, are young people.
Plus one, plus one, plus one, plus one, plus one. Yes, that I agree with you 100%. I also appreciate your point around the organizing. I'm gonna ping to you, Michelle, on this because you mentioned organizing is a scary word, but and that it shows up in so many different ways. And it's part is that part of the narrative change, or does that require a narrative change for people to really see it, see it for what it is? And my question to you, Michelle, is if we're thinking about Samisha's phrasing of what organizing could look like, do we bring industry partnerships into that? Do we bring like the coalitions in childcare that we've been doing and at the national fund around that? Do we, you know, you just led this really successful strategic planning process with the national fund. Talk a little bit about how that shows up in relation to what Tamisha's talking about, because it sounds very connected.
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, the National Fund perspective, my perspective as well, is that labor markets are local. I mean, there's of course global national forces at play, but at the end of the day, it's really critical that strategies are shaped locally. And that's no matter what the what administration, what the political, who's in power, it's always going to matter. I think it matters even more now that we have an ability to work effectively locally, because there are so many disruptions to federal funding for basic workforce and education services and training and all that. And I mean, to be quite honest, I think there is a big unknown that I'm holding around. At some point, like there's things you can do locally to organize different critical institutions and to bring workers and employers to the table, as not just, you know, people who are benefiting from services, but like really having them be part of creating solutions. And we've done that. And our network partners have been able to do that in some cases. And that gives me a lot of hope, especially because I think when you get down to the local level, of course, politics are still present, but it's not the same way at the national level. Because once you get more real and you get away from the theoretical and just like talking heads to like, here is an issue in this community that no matter what your political beliefs are, you can recognize that lack of access to childcare is keeping people from working. It's keeping businesses from finding the talent that they need. That's hurting the community. Then you start focusing more on the problem itself. And if you're data driven and all that, you're going to naturally, not naturally, but if you're committed to really looking at data and what it tells you, that's going to lead you to solutions that advance equity, I believe. And I've seen that happen in our network, even in places where, the community is more right-leaning, and even like who's at the table. It's not always people who believe us the same way, but they can recognize that there's a problem in place and something has to be done about it. And yeah, I think whether it's industry partnerships where you're bringing multiple employers together to think about industry needs as a whole and the other education and training providers that they need, or cross-sector coalitions. And that's, Michelle, what you're talking about with childcare. This project that we've been leading for a few years now is looking at the power that happens when you bring childcare experts together with workforce development experts. And I think there's so much potential to do more around addressing big systemic barriers that a lot of times can we have a more outsized influence compared to even education and training, because you can have great education and training, but if workers don't have the supports they need to get to work, to keep a job, it doesn't matter. So we've been really encouraged by just seeing what happens when you bring these different groups together, and then their voices will be louder when it comes to advocating for local or state policy or regulation changes, or just like organizing in a different way. Because organizing, I think, is the right word. It's a different kind of organizing, but it's getting people rallied around shared goals. And that's, what really is like the key to success, I think. When you're working on systemic change, you need that.
So, I've heard a couple of a couple of references around innovations, and so I'm curious about innovations that you all are seeing that are genuinely creating equitable opportunities and outcomes for folks across like lines of race and gender and occupations. Are there any that you want to point to or lift up or like they're doing something really, I mean, Raf, Michelle, I know you're going to talk about some of the work we do at the National Fund, but what are you seeing out there in the field that you are really digging?
I mean, so we have thousands of engaged thousands of folks in our coalition. So I always feel like when I answer questions like this, I'm gonna leave somebody out. But
For
here we
example, little caveat, for example.
For example, not an exhaustive list. So Prescolis is doing a lot. I think that the if you look at their the comprehensive support they provide to people, their participants, and they have a job placement rate of 80%, 85% of their grads are earning credentials. Once again, this is going back to industry sector partnerships, sector-based training, right? I think that that's a good, great example. I think that there are some kind of I think of them as kind of oldies but goodies. Like they're still we've been talking about them for a while, but I think they're still relevant. Arkansas Career Pathways Program. They've done a sorry a study it. And 52% of their participants enrolls have at least one credential or degree, compared with 24% of the people who did not enroll. And particularly African American students, three times as more likely to earn a credential. Hispanic students, four times as likely to earn a credential as their Hispanic counterparts that were not enrolled in the program. And so, I mean, the proof is in the pudding, I think, in terms of the study. One of my first assignments slash reports that I did at National Skills Coalition was visiting the Moore Community House Women in Construction pre-apprenticeship program down in Biloxi, Mississippi. And you normally wouldn't think of Biloxi, Mississippi as a haven for equity, but there, like I said, bright spots everywhere. They too, 70% job placement rate, but I think the crux of that program, if I can distill it, is once again meeting women in this case where they are, right? And providing a holistic set of support so that women are not only exposed to construction apprenticeships and the trades, but the supports that they need, from assistance with legal to connecting them with their apprenticeship. It's not just childcare and transportation, which are huge in and of itself, but once again, meeting people where they are. So those I turn in, those are things I think of in terms of bright spots. And just to underscore something that Tamisha said, I believe that I totally co-sign that definition of organizing, like looking at what's working on the local level and pushing for the change that you want to see on local, the state, the federal level, and then being in it for the long haul, because those changes at that those different levels are going to be going to take different amounts of time. So that's I think what we really need to see the change that we want to see.
Shout out to Biloxi, Mississippi. I'm just going to do a little segue here. I don't know to this day how it happened, ended up on a plane with 10 business people. I didn't know any of them, and a pilot named Mad Dog. And we went to Mississippi for the day to do a gambling trip. And I believe I had on a Tina Turner wig. I don't remember how or why that all happened, but anyways, anytime I hear Mississippi, I take an opportunity to tell that story. Sorry, pictures later. Anyways, it's the life I live, I'm telling you.
Is that gonna make the edit? That's what I want to know. Can't wait to find
Yeah,
out.
we keep it all in. I mean, it's, you know.
My grandmother too was a fan of the gambling in Biloxi, Mississippi. So
Excuse me.
that was my reference before doing this report.
The only time I ever went gambling, I won $500. It was it. It was just, I don't know. It was, anyways, ba-dum-bum. All right. So, Tamisha, what are you looking at? You're out and about. You are in these streets. Are there things that you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think because it's top of mind, and I feel like right now I'm in a position to have more curiosities and a lot of questions right now while I'm looking for and at solutions, which is a fun space to be because I don't have to implement anything. I can just be like, "Ooh, that's cool." so that's an interesting thing. But I will say, and this is coming off the heels of the conference that I was at last year was called RECESS 25, and RECESS stands for, and I'm looking at my notes, Resilience and Equity in the Clean Energy Sector Summit. This was a national conference. This is the third year they've been doing it. It's in Detroit, and will always be in Detroit, but it pulls people nationally, and there were some people there from Canada as well. And the level of like innovation in that room was really inspiring because as someone who does not, this is where I still have questions and curiosities, right? Like as someone who does not know really that sector, but to be able to begin learning and understanding that it's everything from the people who, may install solar panels on your house or in a solar yard someplace, to, if you decide to buy an EV vehicle, all the people who have to build, install, and maintenance those things, to all the other like little innovative things that people are coming up with and ideas that they're coming up with to address like the climate change reality here. Like that for me was really exciting to see like the job potential for folks, the career potential for folks. And like the entrepreneurship space for that as well. That and it all of it hap a lot of it happens at the local level. And the opportunity there, I think, for people to like get curious, both as like consumers, right? Because people gotta buy stuff, like of clean energy technology, but how that that need for addressing whatever climate issue is happening in your local economy or your local community translates back to jobs. And it's super, like, it's clearer in that energy than I really fully understand it in other energies, other industries, other than maybe healthcare. And so for me, I think there's a lot of opportunity for innovation and curiosity, investment there. And it was funny, one of the women on one of the panels was like, yes, VC money is hard to get, right? Like that type of capital is hard to get. But I'm going to go straight to the consumer and the buyers and the people who are directly impacted by climate change. And that's where I'm going to get my money and my resources and my workers to do the work. And so I just think that's a space where I think we can get curious, and that it is going to vary in every place. Like the way that LA is addressing climate change after the fires looks very different than the way that we might be thinking about climate change here in Michigan. But we still have to address it. We still have to figure it out. We still need innovators to come up with solutions, and we still need workers to get the work done. And it's a really tight, like, kind of like labor market economy circle there that I'm curious about.
Michelle, you want to talk a little, I feel like there are lots of innovative things happening. I'm at the National Fund, a very different space, and it's really trying to be responsive to where we, just where we sit in the world today. You want to talk a little bit about what you're most excited about or what you're seeing that is giving you lots of hope?
Yes. I do. I mean, the first thing I always go to whenever innovation comes up is, yes, like we need to think creatively. We need to look differently at problems. We need to have space and encourage innovation. Yes, that's all true. And also the hard day-to-day work of just keeping people, at the same table. The work that, intermediaries do, collaboratives do, that it's just not sexy, but it's something that is needed, has to be in place, I think, for innovation to go from like an idea to something that can be implemented and sustained. So I don't know, I always feel the need to bring that up. I do think that you can accomplish a lot just in bringing people together to identify where there might be changes in policy or practices that this coalition might have control over. There's a lot to do there. But then what I think is exciting to me when I think about like innovation, new ideas, is what can be possible when you approach how you design workforce programs or training programs or how you design workplace practices, do that differently by having workers, job seekers at the table at the beginning. And, through human-centered design or other approaches, co-creating, we've been really focusing on finding ways to have human-centered design baked into the work that we do at the National Fund, whether it's addressing big barriers, changing, improving job quality, or improving career navigation and training programs. And I think you can, when you talk to people who have experience navigating a system or a workplace, you're just going to get a different view and a lot of expertise that comes from, that lived experience and just like great ideas that normally you wouldn't get when it's just a group of people maybe who have been doing work for a long time that keep coming back to the same ideas. Like mix it up, bring different people in.
Can you give us an example? I mean, because we are doing this, but to talk about can we give a real world example of what that looks like in some of our work?
Yeah, sure. So some of the work that we're doing in workplaces is around having employees at the table and educating them about like having that, looking at them, I think, I don't know, to make sure Melissa said this earlier, that they're not a burden, that they are, it's an asset to have workers think about the way a business operates. And if you treat them as, more as partners versus like people that you're just paying, they can help identify ways to make your business run more efficiently and effectively. And so we have some employers that we're working with right now in our network, whereby having those employees at the table, they're identifying ideas of like how to have savings and costs. And then what those companies are doing is translating those savings and increased profit into increased compensation for workers. And so we've actually seen like huge increases in people's compensation, whether it be through wages or bonuses or some combination, because they were just treated differently and they were brought in and they're They're invested differently in that company. So that's just, one example.
Among many, yes, that's very. So we are coming close to time here. So I want to end with a question around a thought around challenging assumptions. So if you could challenge one assumption or practice in the workforce development ecosystem today, something policymakers, employers, or practitioners, something that we take for granted, what would that be? And if you need 10 Jeopardy seconds to think about that, because I'm not sure if we teed that question up, but I'm just curious about assumptions or practices that you would challenge today.
You can only pick one.
You can pick a couple. This is where I do my Jeopardy. Do, 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 right? Well, I'll tell you what I'm thinking about, particularly in the evaluation and learning space. I mean, and we've done this as we've been as part of our new strategic plan and thinking about how we set our work up to do that work. How do we set ourselves up to do that work? Is about it goes back to this idea of what success looks like and how we tell those stories of success, and how do we do that from the perspective of the people that we are in partnership with on the ground, right? And again, I think it's not just about, I mean, measurement, it matters, but really leaning into the different ways of knowing, and particularly when things are shifting and again, I do think numbers and data, the quantitative matters a whole bunch, and it's directional, but also the storytelling I feel like needs to be amped up to support that because things are changing so rapidly. And so I don't know, that's, and I don't know if there's an assumption or a practice around that. Well, I think there's a practice around, I don't know, I'm rambling at this point, but I do think there's something about how we speak to what's working. In a way that speaks to the lived experiences of folks, because there's so much truth in that, and people can hold on to that and they can understand that sometimes, I think, more than just the numbers. And I'm not suggesting that anybody's doing that, but we are really leaning into the storytelling part of this work as a way to speak to the difference it's making in the lives of others. So that's what I'm thinking about. And I think more of it. How can we do more of it in the field?
Michelle, if I can, what I think I hear you saying, and I think this is an assumption I would want as the question too, is I think there is an assumption for practitioners, for those of us who work on policy, that if we're doing good work and we have good data, that should be enough to sustain that work, right? And so what I hear you saying more is that we need to be also telling the narrative, telling the story of that work. And that is something we've at National Skills Coalition on this on in our state work are trying to do more of is telling those stories. So if that's what I hear you saying, then
It
I
is.
definitely agree with that. Interrogating that assumption and changing that. And then the other assumption that I think I would want us to change in question is that if we're investing either on a state or federal level, even on a local level, in one area, that we don't need to pay attention to other areas. Like if we're putting a lot of emphasis on apprenticeship, then that's where we can focus right now instead of thinking about, once again, like what are those things that people need to succeed in apprenticeship, whether it's childcare or whether it's cash assistance or something like What are the other holistic supports that people need to succeed in programs? And once again, thinking about what people need to be economically mobile holistically. So I think like getting out of that single focus thinking is another assumption.
The old we can walk and chew gum at the same time. Anybody else want to get in on a challenging assumption?
Yeah, I'll go. And this is an assumption that I've been wanting to break, and I see progress, but I'm gonna keep like saying it, is that that people do have agency in this system, and that like employers do not have to be at the center. They are a piece of it, but they are not the sole customer in this workforce development, economic mobility ecosystem, whatever it is we want to call it. But that like at the end of the day, all of us are customers and stakeholders, whether that's workers, whether that's communities, whether that's businesses, because all three of those have a symbiotic relationship with each other if we really want to have a healthy and thriving economy. And I'm gonna, I think I prob this will probably, I don't know, be on my headstone or something, but like that, like we have to keep people and communities at the center of workforce development. Otherwise, it will not work and our economy will not function.
Economic mobility ecosystem. I like it. Bradford and
I need
Michelle.
to trademark that before somebody steals it from me.
Yeah, what I'm thinking about right now is challenging the idea that advancing equity means that other people are going to lose, and advancing equity means that people who are unqualified are going to get jobs. That's obviously been shaping a lot of policy this year and before, and it will continue to. I truly believe that equity is good for families, it's good for businesses, it's good for communities. And even if you don't feel drawn like morally or ethically to care about equity, the fact of the matter is the country's changing, it's going to continue to change. And if and businesses and others don't figure out how to adapt and change, they're not going to be able to be successful. It's there is just a strong case to be made that yeah, advancing equity, it's good for everyone.
This has been a really good conversation, y'all. I so appreciate you and makes for a great Monday. So I want to thank you for agreeing to spend some time with me. Did y'all have fun? Did y'all have fun? Yes.
Yes,
Well, good. I
absolutely.
want you to have fun. I want you to have fun. right. Thank you, and we'll see you in the system. The ecosystem, the economic mobility system, trademark TM, TM. All right.
Michelle,
Thank you.
Thank you.
State of Our Workforce is a production of the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. This episode was produced by Josh Enoch. The music in this episode is produced by Alex Productions. You can find past episodes of State of Our Workforce on our website at www.nationalfund.org. To stay updated on State of Our Workforce and all things workforce development, be sure to follow the National Fund for Workforce Solutions on LinkedIn. Don't forget to subscribe to our State of Our Workforce wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. We appreciate you tuning in and look forward to bringing you more valuable conversations in the future. Remember, everybody, life is tricky, so stay in your magic.